The following is a product of the Uprising High School Ministry at The Grove.
All right, so I'll continue to show this video series, and it can be a little dramatic, maybe a little bit, but it's so spot on, and maybe a little cliche at times, and predictable, but it gets better, I promise you. Next week has like the biggest cliffhanger, and then the final week kind of wraps it up in a really interesting way. So it'll continue to get better and better. The acting, not so much, but the storyline in itself is pretty good. So we've been starting this series. We started the series a week ago, defined, looking at our image and our identity. And last week, I kind of challenged everybody to sort of like describe yourself or define yourself, who you are, without answering kind of those basic questions. Let me go back on my notes. A couple of questions put out, like, if you were to describe who you are to somebody without saying what you do, where you're from, and things you like, or your favorite color, and things like that, like, how would you describe yourself? How would you define yourself? And could you do it without saying things like, hi, my name's Jared, and I work at a church, and I'm a dad, and a husband, and I like green and pizza every day. How do you share who you are? And so I thought I kind of did that last week, and like I thought I kind of myself sort of answered who I am without using those sort of shallow descriptions of our life, right? Without describing the shell, but who we are in our core, the yoke of our image. And I didn't, and I was reminded of that by Bree, and she was like, you better share, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I didn't do that. I tried to play it off like I just forgot, but I honestly didn't even think about it, so here's my confession. And so I had to sit down, and I had to think, like, man, who, can I even do that? Can I define who I am? And without, like, the cliche, like, a child of God, you know, like, because I think that's, like, okay, good job, you know some scripture, you know what you're supposed to say at church. And so I had to really think about it. And so the way I did it is like, okay, I did it sort of by looking at myself through the lens of the world, and what would the world say about me, and then what does God say about me in that? And so the first thing I put is the world would look at me and say I'm an emotional crybaby. And I am. I really, like, on an outside, I cry a lot for a guy, maybe for even anybody. I probably cry than most of the girls in this room. I can't go see, like, Nicholas Sparks movies, not because I'm too manly, but because I'm not manly enough. I lose it, and I weep. Any kind of movie like that. I remember one time, Jill and I, we went to this Harkins right here, Chandler Crossroads, and we saw the movie P.S. I Love You. Have you seen this with Gerard Butler? Basically, so he's like the main guy, and they fall in love, and it takes place in Ireland, which in and of itself is just this like awesome romantic place. Jill and I went there on our honeymoon, and Gerard Butler, you know, he's just stunning, and his accent's beautiful, and you know, he's a cute guy. And so basically, he, spoiler alert, if you don't want to know the story, shut your ears if you can do that. He dies, but after he dies, I don't even remember if they're married or just hooking up or whatever, but they're in love. And it's Hollywood, you know, it doesn't matter. And so she starts getting letters that he had written to her from the grave, that'd be weird, but like before he died. And he like had them basically scheduled to where she would get them every so often, I think up to like a year out or a few years out or whatever. And in that first year, she's getting them pretty often, and they start to span and get less and less and less, but it always ends with, P.S. I love you. And just it was just this most sad, depressing ending, and we're walking out of the theater. I told Jill, I'm like, here's the keys. You have to drive. Like, I can't keep it together right now. And we get in the car, and I'm like, I'm just starting to, like, you know, come back to reality a little bit. And she goes, can I ask you something? I'm like, yeah, what's up? What would you do if I died? Why do you have to ask me that right now? Lost it. I'm like bawling, just like looking out the window. Like, she's like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm fine. I'm fine. I just like breathed in a cat or something. I don't know. I'm an emotional guy. Now the world would call me an emotional crybaby, weak. I think God looks at me, and I've learned in God, finding my identity in God, that I'm passionate and I'm compassionate. And I think that they're strengths. And it's, yeah, maybe as a guy, especially 6'5", and this was back when I was like 300 pounds, 6'5", so like, you know, and like bawling like a little girl. But I'm passionate. I've learned in God that it's healthy to show emotion. And that if something causes me to want to weep, then I should weep for it. If something causes me to want to laugh hysterically, then I should do that until I just can't stop and I feel like I have to go to the hospital, which has happened. I'm passionate and emotional. I wear my heart on my sleeve. I'm vulnerable. It's who I am. It's how God has sort of wired me and made me. I think the world would look at me and call me a wuss in the sense of if someone wants to fight me, it's not going to happen. I won't throw a blow. Now, I say that if someone was coming at my wife or my daughter, things might change. But I would still probably try to talk to the person first and like try to show them love. I can't help it at 2 a.m. Even in high school, even before Christ. Now, before Christ, I just thought, okay, I'm just a wuss. I don't like to fight, whatever. But I've come to find out that after Christ, it's no, I'm not a wuss. I'm a peacemaker. In high school, we used to go to parties and stuff, and it wasn't a high school party unless there was a huge street brawl every single time, or if it just happened in the house. I remember one time there was actually two parties. It was at one party at one house. I didn't know either of these ones. And it was kind of like more lowerclassmen, underclassmen, and I was at that one. I think I was a sophomore. And then there was another party up the street that had a lot of mainly seniors and a few juniors and stuff. And basically, because underclassmen are stupid, one of us went out there and like tried to go into that party just to be an idiot, because when you're an underclassman, you're stupid, and go in and start a fight. Basically, they get mad, and here's what I love. This is what I think is just like awesome and stupid and just interesting about high schoolers. They get so mad that they want to fight so bad, but instead of doing it in the heat of the moment, and like emotionally, they're like, well, let's schedule this out. You know, when are you available in the next 10 to 15 minutes? Does on that street light, you know, does that corner sound good out there? There's a light under it. I feel like people could watch and get a good view from all angles. You know, it's kind of in the middle of both parties. So we get out and we go in, and both the groups are kind of crowding around, and some people are excited and some people are like, what's happening? Are we going to another party? What's going on? And the two guys are standing there, and they begin to start where they left off, you know, like they got mad at each other inside this house prior, and then, you know, they scheduled a fight, so that's how fights work, you schedule them, and so we come together, and they're standing there, and they're, it's like they're trying to get themselves worked back up over whatever stupid thing they were worked up against in the beginning. I don't know, like someone drank their beer or something like that, and it's happening, and I see this underclassman kid, and he's a small guy. And this other classman, the senior guy, he was a good size. And I was obviously, I've always been a little bit bigger than most everybody my age, and older even. And so I see this kid, and he's going to get worked, and I'm like, okay, this can't happen. It's not a fair fight. Like, the senior guy on top of it had guys who were like threatening to jump in anyways, which is like, come on, dude, like that's not honorable. And so I walked out, and I stood in between these guys, and I made them talk to each other and have a conversation without yelling. With like 150 people walking around. I was stupid. I was just as much of a stupid sophomore as the other kid was. And but I had them talk, and they ended up shaking hands, and they were fine. Next thing I know, I look over here. Two guys are upset that there wasn't a fight, so they just start fighting. Whatever. You can't. I'm not a wuss. I'm a peacemaker, but sometimes people are just so stupid, you just have to let them punch each other. The world would look at my life and where I've come from and say that I had a broken home, that I'm a bastard, that my dad left me. God looks at me and says, no, you have a heavenly house. I'm preparing a room for you. I am your father, and I will never leave you nor forsake you. What did I, sorry, I was kind of chicken scratching this. The world would look at me and say, I'm extremely conservative in how I live my life, in the things I choose to consume, partake in, view, watch. I would just say that I'm obedient to God. And that I just try to obey his commands and what he wants for my life. And that might seem conservative to the world, and it might not make sense to the world. And even sometimes it doesn't make sense to me, but I know that since my God, my Savior, has asked me to do it, that I have to be obedient in that, regardless of how conservative or whatever word you might put in front of it. The other term might be maybe crazy Christian or Jesus freak, or no one really uses this term anymore, Bible thumper, or religious, I think is probably the word most commonly used. Religious nut. God looks at me and he doesn't see a religious nut or a crazy Christian, or maybe he does, but I think he would call me instead someone who's faithfully in love. Faithfully in love with the God, with the Creator who loved me first, who gave his life to me, for me, before I even knew him. And so when I look at who I am, if I was going to share, just to smash it all up into one sentence, I'm a passionate peacemaker who has a heavenly house waiting for him, tries to be as obedient to God as possible, regardless of how crazy it might seem, because I'm faithfully in love. Now, maybe that might be just might be an extended version of saying child of God or whatever, but the reality is that is who I am. That's who I am. I tried on the image of baseball player. I tried on the image of soccer player, which that didn't work because that's just way too much running involved. So I was like, hey, goalie, please. Just here for halftime, oranges and stuff, you know, Capri Suns. I tried on motocross, the motocross image, racing. I tried on BMX. I tried on the jock image. I tried on the golf image. I was on the golf team freshman year. Even my senior year, I did cheer. My second half of my senior year, I tried cheer. I did that. Single bass, I could do it all, man. I was a stud. I could single bass, and I broke my wrist from a car accident because my friend was speeding and stupid. And then I sued him. Not everybody can say that they've sued their side note. The way he found out I sued him was I crashed at his house because maybe we were partying. And his dad comes in the next morning, and we were in bed together. He had a king-size bed. It was a huge bed. Sounds weird. But there was really no one else to sleep. And it's like, floor or bed? Bed. I don't care. We're friends. It's cool. So he comes in, and he throws this huge stack of papers, manila envelope, like legal stuff and all this stuff. And he goes, I hope you love your boyfriend laying in bed with you because he's suing your pants off right now, but I could see they're already hot. I mean, it was real awkward and weird. It was hot. It was in the summer. You just, you know, it was whatever. Relax. Not everybody can say that they've sued their friend. I can. We're not friends anymore. So I want to kind of continue today just looking at our definition and how do we define ourselves and how does God define us. I think when we look at the examples I gave of the world's view and God's view, it kind of sums up what we're going to look at today. In 1 Samuel 16, God is basically calling Samuel. Saul is king at this time, and God tells Samuel, hey, I've removed my blessing from Saul. He's not going to be the king. I'm going to give my blessing to someone else. I need you to go over to this guy's, Jesse's house, and one of his sons I have prepared to take over as king. 1 Samuel 16, 6. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab, which is one of Jesse's sons, and thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And so basically, it's sort of this like that sort of dodgeball, pick your dodgeball team moment. Like you stand there and you're looking at people and you're looking at everyone. You're like, glasses? No, because if you are running around, you're going to lose those. You're not going to be able to see the ball. You're going to be out in 2 seconds. You're not on my team. You know, Samuel kind of comes and he goes, and you have to remember the king they have, Saul, who God let the people pick, right? The people got to pick Saul as their king. He was handsome and wise and good looking and just everything. If you could pick basically of all the rulers of the other cultures in the world at that time, if you could pick all their best attributes and put them into one person, that was Saul. And so they had this on this outward appearance, they had this amazing king. And then God was like, listen, like this time around, I'm picking the king. And I could care less what he looks like. I care more about what his heart looks like, who he is as an individual. And so Samuel comes and he's getting ready to anoint, you know, the next king. And he sees Eliab and he goes, man, this guy's huge. He's massive. If I've ever seen a king, this is the guy right here. If I'm ever going to pick someone to be on my team, that's the guy. I mean, look at him. And God says, no. Nah, this guy doesn't even come close to making the team. I don't look at what the world sees. I don't look at the outside appearance. I look at the heart. And then Jesse called Abinadab, and he goes through all the sons. And basically what happens is he goes, Samuel goes, well, is that it? Those are all your sons? Because none of these are the ones the Lord has anointed. None of these are the ones the Lord has chosen to be the next king. And he goes, well, I got one more son. He's the youngest. He's little. And he's out with sheep right now, shepherding some sheep. And they call him in, and he comes in, and it's David. The same David who defeats Goliath, the same David who becomes king, the same David who is called a man after God's own heart, the same David who takes his best friend's wife, gets her pregnant, and then sends his friend to go get killed because nobody's perfect. That's a man after God's own heart. But still, maybe he's not perfect and maybe he doesn't look the part, but his heart was a heart after God's own heart. And so God chose him. In Luke 16, verses 1 through 15, there's this parable. It's called the parable of the shrewd manager. And Jesus is sharing it, and he's telling it to his disciples. I'll just read it to you. It says, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master's taken away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. So he cuts the guy's bill in half, his debt in half. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves. I'll explain that in a sec. So when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. And he said to them, you are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight. First, I just want to kind of go back to what Jesus said. He says, use, in verse 9, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, right? So if you want to have friends, offer everybody to buy their lunch every single day for the rest of your life, and you're going to have all the best friends in the world. No. Basically, what he's saying is use your wealth well. Use what's been given to you, what you've been entrusted with. Manage it well. Don't waste it. Don't mistreat it. Don't take advantage of it. Don't take it for granted. Use it well and use it for other people around you. Take care of others so when the time comes that you need to be taken care of, they're going to be more than gladly willing and desire to take care of you in return. And the Pharisees are like, kind of look at Jesus like, why would we do that? Like, why would anybody just kind of like give whatever they have to whoever? Like, that doesn't make sense. And Jesus looks at the Pharisees and says, listen, you guys might look like you're the religious, perfect people and all this stuff, but you don't have it together at all. I know your hearts. I know what you're really about, and all that you do is just so other people can see you do it. Go to one more verse, and then we'll kind of close this up. Galatians 1:10. Am I now trying to, this again, this is Paul writing to the people who have given their life to Christ in this small church. I'm now trying to win the approval of human beings. Am I now trying to win the human of, oh my gosh. Let me remember how to read. Am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Or am I trying to please people? If I were still trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ. Plainly put, you can't serve what people want out of you, what the world says you should have, and also serve Christ. Because they're two completely opposite things. You cannot serve the world and yet also serve Christ. And I don't mean serve the world in the sense of going out and doing missional stuff. I mean serve the world in the sense of the world is your master. Every single one of us is a slave to something. We're owned by something. Whether you admit it or not, something owns you and dictates how you live, how you walk, how you talk, whatever it is. And I think more often it tends to be our peers. It tends to be the world. It tends to be the culture that tells us how we should live and what we should look like and what we should do. And we care way too much about what people think. But it's so freaking tempting, right, to win the approval of people. Man, it feels so good when someone just compliments the way you look or compliments how you act or compliments something you achieved in school or sport or whatever. It feels so freaking good when someone just gives you that compliment because they're praising you. And it's not wrong to compliment, and it's not wrong to be complimented, but when we make our life and our decisions and who we are about people's approval, we lose who we really are, and we just become what the world wants us to be. But it's a hard temptation to give up on. We care more about people's opinions of us than we really even care about them. See, God doesn't say, leave people alone, get away from the world. He just says, don't worry about what the world says about you or what the world says you should do. Just love the world or love everybody in it and live in it, but don't be of it. And so, who do you try to get to notice you? Think about it. Who do you try to get to notice you? Maybe you're throwing a selfie up. Maybe there's one person you're trying to get, or maybe it's just anybody. Man, it's so much fun to just to like favorite things on Twitter now that the star explodes. I find myself favoriting things I don't even care about. I'm just like, yeah. Wait, I probably shouldn't favor that. That's awkward. Sorry, I get distracted. Who are you trying to get to notice you? And I'd ask, is it you that they're even noticing, or is it some false fake version of you. My hope is that here at church, and I think it's easy to get lost and forget who we are throughout the week, especially at school, surrounded by so much and so many different people. But my hope is that when you come here, or any body of believers, that you would remember who you are. And that really, and when you read scripture, when you're in the word and you're praying, that you would remember who you really are. How you're defined, not how the world sees you, but how God sees you. And then in turn, live that out. And care more about that definition of who you are than any other definition that the world or any other person can give you. Be yourself here. I hope that you would feel free to be as silly, goofy, awkward, dumb, Y-O-U as much as you can be. Even if it's uncomfortable for someone, be yourself. Make people uncomfortable. And be yourself. And I hope that you would help people to feel the same way, that they can be themselves 100%. I'll just end with this. When my buddy got me to go to church with him after asking a million times in high school, finally went, and what I found wasn't what I expected. What I found was that I could, for the first time, relax and sort of lose this anxiety, this pressure of like, man, I just have to look good. If I slip, if I fall, if I say something stupid, whatever, like, I'm done. There goes my image. It's gone. Here's what's amazing. Here's what I found. Our image in the world is so freaking fragile. The second one person doesn't like it, it's a balloon. It just pops and it explodes and you're done. You're lost. You don't know who you are. Nobody wants to hang out with you. Nobody wants anything to do with you. And that's it. But what I found in this youth group, and that I hope that any youth group I'm ever a part of, and any youth group anywhere that claims to have Christ at the center of it, I pray that it would be the same way. That you could walk in, be yourself, be as stupid as you are, be as smart and intelligent as however you are, be as ugly as you are, as beautiful as you are, as awkward as you are, as real as you are, be yourself and just feel welcomed and feel like you belong and feel like you're home. And that happens by us being willing to be vulnerable and by us accepting everyone and showing them love and helping all of us together walk towards Christ to be more like him. Let's pray. God, this is a task for every single one of us in this room that is so hard, I think, to overcome. And I think it takes a lifetime, God, to just not look to the world to find our worth, to not look to the world to find our image. God, I just ask that you would help all of us every single day to look to you first. Second, third, fourth, and fifth for our definition, for our identity. And God, when the world is loud and screaming at us on how we should be, on how the world thinks we are, God, I pray.